I know you're used to working alone, but we do things differently here. We have to. Maybe it wouldn't hurt to try something new.
Like move to Alaska?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 428 for the week of October 10th, 2022. I am Better Coffee across the street, David T. Cole, and I'm here with acting copaganda editor, Sarah D. Bunting.
Foya Schmoya.
Wig stylist, Tara Ariano.
I tried.
And woke wussy, Daniel McEachern.
I'm done.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week joining us. He's a journalist and a friend of ours you have heard here many times. It's Daniel Danny McEachern. Hello, Danny.
Welcome back.
Danny.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome back. We are here to talk about the new ABC show, Alaska Daily.
Woo!
Eileen Fitzgerald, Hillary Swank, is a fancy reporter at a fancy New York newspaper. She is also, unfortunately, arrogant. When an underling basically begs her to find a second source for a bombshell story, Eileen just states that her source is solid and everyone who disagrees can fuck off. When serious questions arise following publication and Eileen's editor says the paper is going to re-report the story, Eileen threatens to quit and then does. 4 months later, an old colleague named Stan, Jeff Perry, flies in from Anchorage to offer Eileen a job at the paper that he edits there. The epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women deserves more attention, and Eileen is, in his opinion, the right person to bring it. The show is created by Tom McCarthy, who also wrote and directed the pilot. You may know him better as the writer-director of the Oscar-winning newspaper movie Spotlight. Only one episode has aired so far. That's all we've seen. Let's do the Chen check-in. Danny, should our listeners watch Alaska Daily?
I'm out, but I'm not going to say that there's nothing there for other viewers. It's just not for me.
Okay, Sarah?
They probably shouldn't, but I'm in.
So. Wow.
Gosh.
Yeah. Okay.
Dave?
Only if you want to be reminded what network TV was 15 years ago.
I am going to say no. And if you want to see what network TV was like 15 years ago, more or less, but also there's more fucking, watch a show on Hulu called Reasonable Doubt, which is also not great. But Michael Ealy is in it. And as I said, there is fucking and swears. Let's get into it in detail. Danny, as soon as I told you the show existed so that you could come on to talk about it, both because you are a veteran newspaper reporter and have lived near the Arctic Circle, you predicted a potential problem with the show's setting and subject. And boy, oh boy, did that prediction come true basically immediately. How did it feel to be right in such a terrible way?
It feels pretty good, but then I always feel pretty good about being right, whether the way is terrible or not. The issue that I was worried about with the show would be that it would present kind of a white savior story for a very real problem, which is missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And the pilot has that in spades. At the end of the episode, one of the reporters literally says to Hillary Swank, "We're very lucky to have you," which is a problem. I don't know that after seeing the first episode that I trust this show to do it in a non-superficial way. But there's all kinds of questions about how we cover issues, how we cover people of color versus white people, and what that says about the diversity of our newsrooms, which they're not very diverse.
Yeah.
I think the show is biting off more than it can chew based on what I've seen so far.
Yeah.
I agree. And I'm willing to stipulate you probably don't sell this show to a major broadcast network without having a big star attached. But I feel like you could just as easily make Swank the Jeff Perry character and have Roz, who is, from what we've seen, the only Indigenous person that works at this newspaper, be the actual reporter. Sarah, what did you think about this issue and what Danny said?
In order to get this made at a network, you attach Swank to it, and then you have all of this like exposition and backstory that sort of is stuck in the throat of the narrative for like the first half of the pilot. And it's like, if you would just cut that off and started with her like getting there, going out to the one bar and having, you know, whatever, one night stand with that guy from Mayor of Easttown. Like, why can't you just start in the middle? Oh, that's right. Because they probably tried that. And the network came back and was like, oh, no. We have to locate people. We have to explain to them why a, you know, New York big shot would consent to go to Alaska, blah, blah, blah. And I just kind of kept feeling like once it got to the story, fireworks factory, mm-hmm. it started to pick up. Like, Tom McCarthy knows how to do this part, but the whole, like, everything that you had to wade through because it was sold, pitched to and sold at a network is a problem. Whereas if you made this for Hulu, for Netflix, for Topic, I don't care where else you make it, mm-hmm. but then you don't have the same big font needs to get it sold. And then you can tell the actual story, which is not Hillary Swank coming in and saving this paper. Like, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, every problem that I had with it, and like, there's Hillary Swank with a crazy wall, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, God, here we go. Mm-hmm. I just wish that this were, you know, made for who it's really for, mm-hmm. which is people who are interested in this kind of, you know, journalism stories, processy, like everybody who watches All the President's Men repeatedly to fall asleep, like me. Mm-hmm. It's network notey for yes. half an hour, and then it starts to come online. But how much, like, how far can that go?
Because yeah.
it is still on a network.
Right. This also, Dave, gives the show the 911 problem, where everyone who has legitimate grievances has to get past them by the end of the episode, or else, like, the creators are worried, like, oh, no, our audience won't like the characters. Like, Roz, yeah. who's played by Grace Dove, the aforementioned Indigenous reporter at the paper, she should be resentful of Eileen swooping in on the story, and Stan for bringing Eileen in for, like, much longer than she is, even irrespective of the fact that we find out before the pilot is over. She also has a personal connection to this story. She had a cousin who was missing and, you know, is part of this epidemic that's not getting reported. Was that something that you noticed, Dave, as well? The 911 problem.
More that this show just seemed to pick a topic that seemed at odds with its destination.
Yeah.
Which is like, I honestly could see this working. And this is going to mean nothing to many people. But I actually could see this working in Canada.
Yeah.
Like, because I feel like there's a mandate on, like, the CBC or whatever to actually produce socially aware, tackle social issues and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this being on ABC, it's already sort of whitewashing a lot of what's going on here, you know,
yeah,
by putting
exactly.
Hillary Swank in the lead.
Yeah.
But also, as you were saying, like, the problem of having, like, a really hard story to tackle, but still trying to be in that very, like, as I was saying, 15 years ago, sort of, like, lazy, hazy, walk through the park kind of styling that the show has. It just seems like it's at odds with the story it wants to tell. Like, they picked too hard of a story for the tone that they are presenting here. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe it'll slide. Maybe this is just like the strategy that we have to start here and get into yeah. the disturbing details as we go along. And you see what a big and quiet problem this is. That's possible. But also, from the show economic side of it, how are you going to keep people watching if you feel like, if you're into the issue part of it, the show turns you away? And if you want another fish out of water networky kind of show, then you attach this really dark material to it.
Yeah.
I feel like they're trying to play it both ways right now, and it doesn't seem like it would energize either side of that audience.
Danny, you're Canadian. Do you agree that Canada is better?
In what regards? Because this no, is a big problem,
of course,
in Canada.
Absolutely.
Like,
that
this is has been underreported. Like,
yes.
What I thought, sorry, just to like squeeze in one other thing.
Yeah.
What I thought could have made this show better, and it doesn't work just because temporally it's only become a mainstream news item in the past like 5-10 years. Mm-hmm. But if this was set in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the newspaper was like a place where there are resources and you could kind of like turn back that part of history so that this would be tackled earlier.
Yeah.
That would have been a more compelling show, because the promise of a newspapery journalism story is also at odds with the setting, which is now where everything's underfunded and there's like no money for anything. So
yeah.
like it's a little tricky, but I kind of would have liked to see that.
Yeah. Yes. Versus Anchorage Patch. Totally.
Right. And just to be clear, Canada is not better on this regard. That was a joke. I'm from Saskatchewan. I know there's tons of work to be done everywhere on this issue.
But the point I was making earlier is that Canadian TV might have had a truer take on this.
a few years ago, there was a national inquiry into the problem in a report that was released a few years ago with several recommendations on how to improve the situation. So, I mean, we're certainly here in Canada not better when it comes to the issue. I agree with what Dave said about how I think that we might be a little bit more ahead, at least in some areas, in producing work in regards to this matter. And I work at CBC, which has done a lot of work in this regard, even though we have our own failings to look at as well. I mean, I work in a newsroom that is almost all white, for example, and that's an issue right across the country. And we're taking steps to address that, but we're years, if not decades, behind where we ought to be in this regard, for sure. Mm-hmm. I think the show is trying to be too many things. It's trying to be fish out of water, like Dave says. And it's got this whole backstory. I also agree with what Sarah said, that if you had started the show with her arriving in Alaska and filled in the backstory about how she came to be there, I agree 100% that the whole beginning seemed to be tacked on. And that took me out of the show right away, because then it was full of all the same journalistic cliches that we've seen before. And it just caused me to question how good the show would be on those details. Like, it's a single source story that she's been working on for 5 months, and 5 minutes before publication, she's still being asked for a second source, even though supposedly legal signed off on it.
Yeah.
Even though legal apparently signed off on it, she's still doing that thing where she's on the phone with the editor going, okay, move that line down here. Then legal's going to have to sign off on it again. Like all those sorts of things. Nobody has ever said the phrase woke wussies in their entire life.
Okay, yes. Let's talk about that. Because first of all, I feel like that was all a note from someone too. And like, I would just like to tell all the 50-something TV writer men, like, we'll stipulate it's hard to be you right now. Like, can you fucking shut up about how scared you are of getting canceled? Like, this is a problem on Reboot as well, less so. Also, the idea that like woke wussies are the ones who are torpedoing her story, no pun intended, about this general, like, woke wussies love to prop up the American military. Like, what argument are you even making? Who does she think is mad at her? And about what? Like, all of that just seemed like, we have to wedge this in because it's 2022. This is a topic that people are talking about or were talking about 4 years ago. Like, that was so annoying.
Yeah. Or like, we want the whatever middle of the country, the right leaning middle of the country, to be both sides into watching this up top. Like, just skip over it. Like, this isn't for those people. And then, you know, this whole story with the general is going to come back because you don't cast that guy.
Daniel. Yeah.
Yeah. do not cast that guy if you're fucking around. And I just was like, Hillary Swank, she won't mess with my thing. Like, his line from that Law and Order episode. Like, okay, are we going to have to do this? Like, I don't necessarily need backstory. I've seen a TV show before. I can figure it out.
You know it's going to come back by the end of the season that she was right about the general all along.
Right.
And it would be much more interesting to me if she was wrong about the general and that's why she's disgraced and she wants to redeem herself. Although then you're going to have an issue of, you know, the white woman using this indigenous story to redeem herself. But you just know that by episode 13 or however many episodes there are, she's going to be vindicated and you're probably going to end the season with her deciding whether or not to go back to New York and triumph or stay at Alaska and help continue the work that she's doing there. You know, that's going to go for the show, too. So
Also meet Amy Park, who plays Juna, who's a younger reporter who breaks a story and then says, I don't want to report it because I feel bad. Like, Danny, what did you think about this plot thread?
I didn't like it. I didn't like it, Tara. They make it such a clear choice as to whether or not they should report the story that it doesn't seem realistic that she has this problem with it.
Right.
It's like everybody's first day at school.
Exactly.
There's no assumption of previous experience for any of these reporters that are not Hillary Swank in this newsroom.
That's right.
Being that close to Randall Batenkoff is probably really disconcerting. So in her defense, at a question mark?
Maybe, but I mean, Hillary Swank has to spell it out. He did something illegal and he did it with taxpayer money. This isn't about it isn't necessarily about the gay relationship that he had with this guy that set him up with the apartment with. It's the taxpayer money that he used to fund it. Yeah. And it seems very clear. And it doesn't seem like it'd be the kind of thing that Hillary Swank needs to explain to her or that the editor would send Hillary Swank up to do. You know, he could have done that and he could have explained it right there in the newsroom.
Yes.
I just also feel that the way she talks to the guy at the house and he blurts out, he admits that he did it. Like, It's all Colonel Jessup on the stand admitting that he ordered the code red.
Seriously.
Yes.
That it's just that easy that you ask a question and they come out with it, and that the problem with journalism is not the ways that people can hide what they do. It's just that journalists aren't asking the tough questions. And I know this is a, it's a newspaper, and I'm glad that they do have notebooks with them all the time, because a lot of journalism shows don't even bother with that. But it's also 2022. And if you're showing up at this guy's house to ask him about this stuff, you have a recorder and you have that recorder going.
Yes.
So that when he says that one thing, I meant to pay it back, can't just say, I never said that. And right. You don't have anything to back that up.
Right. All right. It feels like we're winding down, but can we talk about the wig? Because Jesus Christ, like, she has two Oscars. She's an executive producer on the show. Hilary Swank, demand better for your head. It's so ugly and fake.
Yeah.
The only reason I don't want to write the show off entirely is because of the issues that I think it might be introducing some viewers to, and if it does cause some viewers to think about some of the issues presented, then that's a win.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I am not a crackpot, but TV characters who are driving absolutely must keep their eyes on the road. And if they do not do so, they absolutely must get into fender benders as a result. Alaska Daily is certainly not alone in its guilt here, and I could buy, in this case, a retcon stating that because Alaska is not densely populated, young Gabriel feels confident in turning towards his passenger for extended periods. But this rationalization is almost never available to other shows, and likewise, there is almost never any reason for a character who is driving to try to make eye contact with their passenger, because their passenger will not be trying to make eye contact with the driver, because the driver is fucking driving. I have no kick with characters having meep-and-deaningfuls in the front seats of cars. It happens all the time in real life. What also happens all the time in real life is that A, people just watch the road and have the conversation while facing forward, and or B, distracted drivers sideswipe or rear-end others because they're not paying attention. We all know the actors are in a towed car with a camera car in front of it. We are willing to suspend our disbelief on that, and even on a rear projection situation, as long as people aren't turning their entire torsos to one side to gaze at one another while the car is supposed to be in motion. Watch the fucking road or pay the fucking price in universe. I am not a crackpot.
It's time to go around the dial. Our first off is Tara. Tara, what do you have for us?
Well, I talked about Finding Magic Mike on HBO Max. I talked about The Real Dirty Dancing on Fox. Of course, I also had to talk about The Real Love Boat on CBS, premiered last week. Fun fact, all of these are from the same absolute lunatic executive producer, Chris Culvener, who also brought us Holy Moly, but the rest of the time apparently just makes weird shit. I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty of this stupid dating show because it is basically exactly Bachelor in Paradise, except A, people who are never on The Bachelor, as far as I know, and B, it is shot on the actual love boat in the current Princess Cruise Lines fleet. They're also doing this on a regular cruise. Like, anytime scenes are not happening in a bar or like other closed room, the show cast members are surrounded by just random cruise passengers who are like watching in their tank tops from upper decks and stuff, which is weird. One more thing about the format. The kiss-off ceremony, it's called the sail-away ceremony, where two people get booted, takes place outside by one of the ship's pools because no one thought, hey, it's probably going to be kind of windy on the open ocean. And I would report back as to whether they move this indoors for future episodes, except I won't be watching. Also, missed opportunity to put the two guys from the first episode that get kicked off, like, into a lifeboat to, like, row themselves somewhere.
Or
they did
make
not
them
do
walk
that.
The plank.
Or make
Come
them
on.
Walk the plank. So many good ideas.
I was going to say, how about a pirate raid on the love boat yes. as part of this? I mean, we have ideas.
Yeah, we do. Anyway, that's all the background that you need to know, except for the four extremely important clips that I have brought you. First, this comedy bit from our co-hosts, Jerry O'Connell and Rebecca Romaine, is the very first thing that happens in the premiere episode, clip one.
Love, exciting and new. Come aboard. We're expecting.
Look, what are you doing? I loved that show when I was a kid.
Jerry, no need to watch The Love Boat. We're aboard The Real Love Boat.
Let's go.
That happened on television in 2022.
Let's go!
Like, hee-haw level comedy. We already did an extra, extra hot great pegged to married celebrities Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard co-hosting that game show they did on NBC last year. We also have Nick and Vanessa Lachey co-hosting the dating shows from reality TV's other chaos Chris Colon. And now with Jerry and Rebecca, it is officially a trend and I hate it. Speaking of hate, let's hear this take on the theme song, clip two.
Love. Exciting and new. Come aboard. We're expecting you. The love boat. Soon we'll be making a mother run.
Oh, Jesus.
The love boat promises something for everyone. Said love.
Needed a little rap in the middle, I think.
Yeah. If you couldn't tell, that was Jerry O'Connell and Rebecca Romaine singing the theme song. And
that was absolutely in their contract and should not have been.
Oh my God. This song was written for like a tenor. Like you're a producer on the show, I assume. Like tell them to pitch it down for you, Rebecca. That hurt my feelings and my ears. Okay. We're going to get to a typical interaction with two of our scintillating singles. Worth knowing is that the woman, Elisa, won a seat at the captain's table, which means first pick of dudes, at an opening talent show by doing a Pilates move to show everyone she could put her knees behind her head. That's not a joke. It really happened. And the dude is Michael, and he decided his talent was going to be working through his fuckboy tendencies by journaling and writing poetry. And the poem he read at this talent show was this, clip three.
Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm here to find real love, and I hope you are too.
Oh.
This is like a guy in his late 20s, if not 30s.
Lee Sobieski.
I mean.
Sobieski.
Anyway, here's Elisa and Michael getting to know each other.
Do you have like a biggest fear in life?
Regret.
Whoa.
Yeah, I would say regretting, you know, not doing something.
Wait.
For instance, being here. Imagine saying no to this and not being able to meet someone as great as you. What about you though? Biggest fear.
It's ants.
Oh my God.
So that's the real love boat, guys. Like, holy, I'm not probably
you're not
going to
keep watching this.
I mean, it's so boring.
Until the ants.
Oh God.
This is why I do enjoy these reality show dating shows when I do occasionally watch them. It probably sounds like I would do a lot more than is actually the case, but.
But who's this? But just to rewind for a second, let's go back to the room where they were greenlighting this.
Yes.
Who did they think this was for? Because anybody who's going to go on this show and therefore also watch this show has no fucking idea what the love boat is. I barely know what the love boat is. Like, it just seems like it is an expense to license the love boat for $20 a year. It just seems like $20 they could have saved.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I don't either. Mm. I agree.
Well,
let's go.
I have a couple of plugs this week. First, if you were watching Sci-Fi last Saturday, you may have seen Bring It On, Cheer or Die. And I wanted to let everyone know that my editor at Vanity Fair, her name is Case Wickman. She wrote a book about Bring It On. It is called Bring It On, the complete story of the cheerleading movie that changed like everything. No, seriously. And we'll link it in the show notes. It comes out in December. So perfect timing for every Bring It On fan on your holiday gifting list. I'm really excited to read it. I think it's going to be great. And for my other plug, I interviewed Paul Reiser about Reboot, and that's at GQ.com. And we'll link that in the show notes as well. And there's a nice segue into our next item for Dan.
All right, Dan, make this segue count.
One thing I like about what streaming services are doing lately, a lot of them have realized that there is a good reason for the week-by-week drop of episodes. It allows a lot of people to continue watching the show rather than feel that they're missing out if they haven't gotten to it in the first weekend. And one of the shows that we're watching right now is Reboot, as Tara mentioned. And I wouldn't say it's a perfect show. It's a pretty good show. There are a couple of issues. They do a lot of the woke slash canceled humor a little bit. And for a show whose premise is about rebooting an old show as an edgy new version, reboot itself can be a little bit predictable in its notes in terms of characters learning lessons from each other and learning to respect, you know, the other person's point of view. So there's a little bit of hugging and learning going on, but it's pretty funny. And I, you know, as a stereotypical victim in a true crime story, I love to laugh. And I feel that the leads in the show, Keegan-Michael Key, especially Johnny Knoxville and Judy Greer, are all great. And I think, Tara, you also have a Johnny Knoxville interview to, you know, in recent weeks.
I did. Yes, we linked that at the time. Mm-hmm.
They're very enjoyable and they're very good on the show. And that's what keeps me watching. And I think other people should watch it, too.
All right.
Oh, for my plug, we're talking about work that's been done on the topic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And I want to plug a CBC podcast. I work for CBC, but it's not a podcast that I had anything to do with. It's a podcast called Missing and Murdered, Finding Cleo, done by a terrific reporter named Connie Walker. It's about the disappearance of a Cree girl in Saskatchewan in the 1970s. She was taken from her family and adopted into the U.S., and her family believes that she was murdered on her when she was hitchhiking back home. So it's a heavy listen, but it's a true story, and it does get into a lot of the issues that we were talking about that Alaska Daily fails to.
And it's a classic in the true crime podcasting medium as well. You should check it out for sure.
Bonjour, everybody. Mademoiselle Caroline, proudly reporting on the Supernatural prequel, The Winchesters. It's been 2 years since Supernatural ended. 2 long years. So you can imagine how psyched I was to come back to this world. Jensen Ackles is producing, and on paper, he made some very smart choices, like hiring Robbie Thompson as a showrunner. Thompson was a writer on Supernatural. He managed to write all the stellar episodes of the series post-Eric Kripke era. So it should have been amazing from the get-go. However, it's not. I am willing to give it time to become better, though, since it's only a pilot. But the truth is, I'm underwhelmed. It's very piloty, with dialogue like, "You've been chasing your dad since he walked out the door." And the opening scene is also a shameless ripoff of the opening scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Robbie Thompson will have to work hard to find again the magic he created for this franchise, in my opinion. The production design and costuming are, I guess, what one expects from a CW budget. But the truth is, after a few establishing shots to set the 70s, they didn't do much to convince you that the story takes place 50 years ago. Mary Winchester in particular looks nothing like a teen from that time period, which leads me to the casting. And I'm also mixed on that front. Probably because they knocked it out of the park when young John and Mary were first introduced on Supernatural about 14 years ago. I think that being a real fan of the OG series might be an impediment to enjoy this one, ironically. Drake Roger plays John, and he's very tall, and he looks a little like Jared Padalecki, so there's that. Meg Donnelly, who plays Mary, is not a very strong actress, shall we say. But maybe things will improve as they go along. The real breath of fresh air was a character called Carlos, played by a newcomer, as far as I know, called Jojo Flaties, I think. He looks both period appropriate and he's very charming. Jensen Ackles narrates the episode. You can also see shots of him scribbling away at the end. But really, I guess the idea was to use his star power to draw people in. Nothing really justifies his presence here. So overall, I'm not that impressed. But this is a network show, so it might find its pace and groove as time goes by. That is, if the network gives it the time it needs. But as it is, it's a C- for me. Au revoir.
Oh, I'm shocked. I'm genuinely shocked. A C- for the Winchesters.
Quel dommage.
Oh, mon dieu.
Thank you, Caroline.
Yes, thank you so much. That was a nice little treat. Thank you. All right, I just want to give a Werewolf by Night update. It was the subject of Will Dave Hate This, where I conjectured I won't hate this, but it'll be sort of a middling reaction. And actually, it was pretty good. I enjoyed it more than that. It was a fun little tight hour special. They should definitely do more of those and less tertiary characters having a full series if they actually don't have a point of view or something to say, because there's been a couple of those series. So this might be a way to have more with less with Marvel on television, he says in air quotes.
Yeah.
I liked it. I thought it was fun. The performances were good. The style was fine. The only, like, there are some slow moments, but the only real problem I had with it is I just wish they had the courage of their conviction with the whole look and feel of it played out to the very end. That's all. Yeah. I thought the fade into color at the end and then the very non-period end credits could have been rethought and redone in the style. I was saying on another record that they could have taken inspiration from the credits of Frankenstein, mm-hmm. where in Frankenstein, there's actually like they do the credits twice. They're like, and another round for our talented cast of actors. And it scrolls up again and it's all sort of handwritten. Something like that would have been fun. But that's like a really picky thing to say. But that was like the one thing I wish they did differently. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. More of mm-hmm. this, please.
Yeah, I agree. It was better than I expected as well. And if parents are listening and wondering, can my kid watch it or is it too scary? There are fight scenes, but I think like this, the style choice of how it, of the look and feel of it is like, it's very dark. You can't really see a ton. If your kid is a scaredy cat, don't let them watch this. But if they watch like, you know, anything that's kind of like suspenseful, that I don't think the violence is super realistic looking. I don't think it's going to give an older tween and above like bad dreams.
Sure.
There is, however, a character enjoying an entire box of raisins.
All right. Coming up on the Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe on the next Extra, Extra Hot Great this Friday, it is episode 206, Bring It On. It being other genre mix-up, Bring It On recently had a Bring It On meets horror film. And we're going to talk about other ways that they could expand Bring It On into other genres. That is available to all supporters at any level at patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Please join today. Support the podcast. And right here on the next EHG Prime, it is Netflix The Watcher. And we welcome back Dan Rogge for that. All right, it is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Kit, the person, not the car.
Hello, Extra Hot Great team. I'm here today to talk to you about something very important, Taskmaster. I'd like to offer the finale of Series 5, Their Waters So Delicious, for entry into the canon. One of the most important things for any series of Taskmaster is the cast dynamic. And the Series 5 cast of Aisling Bea, Bob Mortimer, Mark Watson, Nish Kumar, and Sally Phillips is one of the show's all-time greatest. They have great chemistry with each other and with Greg and Alex, which makes for tons of standout moments across this series. I've chosen this episode in particular because it showcases the best Taskmaster has to offer, period. Each of the episode's 6 tasks highlights a different element of what makes Taskmaster an international television treasure. Let's get right down to it. We start with a pretty strong prize task, bringing the most awkward thing for somebody else to take home. This is an excellent challenge for a few reasons. It's not too weird or complex like some of the prize tasks have been. There's a huge range of possible options. And of course, the winner does have to take the prize home. Some of the prizes are a bit lackluster, but that's more than made up for by Mark and Nish. Mark brings in a full bathroom set. That's a tub, toilet, and sink. And as for Nish, clip 1.
I've bought 14 kilograms of curry.
Would that be awkward? I mean, look. Take me for an example. Would that be awkward for me to get out of the studio?
Well, it's in a walk.
It's a clever prize task with pretty strong prizes. 4 points. The main tasks all shine as well. In the first, everybody's been given a coconut, which they have to take as far away as possible without touching the ground. One of Taskmaster's perennial strengths is tasks featuring adults basically playing a kid's game. In this case, the floor is lava, and trying to outsmart it with wildly varying results. That's on full display here. Mark gets a sound guy to give him a piggyback ride to the river. Smart. Where he dismounts to throw the coconut, thereby standing on the ground and getting himself disqualified. Oops. Contestants hacking the task is always fun. hacking the task and failing is even better. Brilliant tactics backfiring spectacularly is one of Taskmaster's most rewarding tropes. So task number one earns a full 5 points. Task two, where the contestants are asked to create a graph, is also a winner because in true Taskmaster form, it combines wide open parameters with a motley collection of absurd props. Before the task gets started in earnest, Bob Mortimer gets down on all fours and starts digging a little hole in the sand for the task envelope. Probably one of the best things you'll ever see in your entire life. And let's talk about Bob for a second. A big part of Bob's charm is the fact that he's a gifted and delightfully bonkers storyteller, which his discussion of his urine graph, yeah, you heard that right, shows off. Clip two.
If you're thinking of collecting vast amounts of piss, go up to Dumfries and Galloway, which I was. If you only want small amounts, e.g. for household use, you might like to consider East Sussex.
How did you get this assistant?
No, that absolutely accurate, because I was looking into purchasing gallons of piss. Because I was in dispute with the Woolwich Ferry man. I thought, fuck it, I'll fill his boat with piss. Where do I need to go?
All of the graphs are definitely worth a look, but the studio chat about the graphs is, well, here's just a sample of what I think is one of the best rounds of task banter in the show's history. Clip three.
Correct me if I'm wrong, on this, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, light entertainment show, what you've produced is a graph that shows the pointlessness of democracy.
Not just of democracy, but of all human endeavour, basically. But to be fair, if people are watching Taskmaster, they realise that already.
It's another well-deserved 5 points. Next, there's a solo task where Sally Phillips makes puns. It's admittedly a little dull. However, those sneaky solo tasks are another fun Taskmaster trademark. That's got to be worth at least 3 points. And now, buckle up. Because what comes next is one of the greatest things of all time ever. It's a team task, with series-long affable losers Mark and Anish facing off against Bob, Aisling, and Sally. The teams meet a woman named Rosalind and are tasked with writing and performing an original song about her life. The task gives us a twist on not one but two Taskmaster hallmarks, the short-term artistic challenge and the get-to-know-a-stranger challenge. The teams perform on a small stage outside for an audience of just Rosalind, with Alex off to the side taking notes. Mark and Nish go first. Clip four.
Good evening, London! We are the Diverse Stripes. I am Jack Brown, and this is my wife's sister, Mark. This is called I'm Always Seeing You, open brackets, do cool stuff, close brackets. Close brackets.
All right, and... 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh yeah. I saw you translate a poem from Japanese. It looked so tricky, but you did it with ease. I saw you judging long jump at the athletics. I felt so low, cause it's born, I'm just pathetic. I'm always seeing you do cool stuff. I try my best, but it's never good enough.
Their song is brilliant, and they're having the time of their lives. Next, the other team perform their song, titled Quite Good Considering. Clip 5.
Rosalind married Alan from her string quartet. Fiddling with her friends, you know that is how they met. The free thing about Alan, Alan could not be dreamier, but the viola player sadly, well, he contracted septicemia. Rosalind's a fucking nightmare. She's just quite hard for a woman of her age. Rosalind's average children. She plays quite well,
but not in front of people. Not in front of people.
This team's filming on a ridiculously windy day, and at several points during the performance, Alex has to dash around to pick up stuff that's blown over. This chaotic background is contrasted with Rosalind's complete and total lack of reaction. Everything about this task is magnificent. From Nish and Mark's reaction when Rosalind says her favorite band is Mozart, to Bob's absurdist interview questions, to Bob, Sally, and Aisling tapping their feet out of rhythm with one another while they sing. There are few things better than the passion in Bob's voice as he sings, "Rosalind is a fucking nightmare." These two songs are twin jewels in the Taskmaster crown, and the song for Rosalind Task is one of the best tasks the show has ever produced and may, in fact, be the pinnacle of human achievement, 1,000,000 points. The last studio task involves lots of broken egg. Yet another Taskmaster classic. 4 points. If you've been keeping track, you'll know that that means that this episode scores an impressive 21,000,000 points. If we think about Taskmaster as a combination of tasks, solutions, contestants, great studio banter, and memorable moments, this delivers on all counts. It would be so easy to reduce this episode down to just Rosalind the geriatric athlete. But in fact, it's nearly perfect Taskmaster from start to finish. Every part of the episode, even that slightly dull pun task, shows off what makes Taskmaster special. It's chock full of tasks that hit all the show's best points. The studio chat doesn't lag for a second. The wholesome, adorable Mark and Nish friendship, one of the series' best elements, is on full display. And there are loads of great little moments, like Sally sitting on a mannequin head, Alex telling Greg that the price of his cardboard cutouts on Amazon has dropped, and Nish breaking his live task egg literally as soon as the task starts. This episode combines everything that's great about Taskmaster in one convenient, sing-alongable package. That's why I hereby ask that you induct Series 5, Episode 8 of Taskmaster, "Their Water's So Delicious," into the Extra Hot Great canon. Your time starts now.
Kit, thank you so much for this presentation. Normally we go to our guest first, but I think we should start with Sarah and then do Danny next, because she is the least Taskmaster versed among all of us.
I'd also like to add that the second band's band name was Products of Conception, which, like, sure, what a perfect Taskmaster thing. This was extremely enjoyable. After a while, I just stopped taking notes because I was laughing. I think the presentation really covers why this is an exceptional episode of TV, period. This is absolutely a show that knows its strengths, showcasing them really well. The idea of the curry on the tube is very funny to me. Alex trundling after the cameraman, giving the contestant a piggyback ride, very funny to me. This show has a really good internal ear for its own balance of, like, funny wordplay. It's edited really well. It understands what tasks are going to work and which ones should go with each other within an episode. And based on my comparatively limited exposure to Taskmaster, I would say this is, you know, quite an exceptional 45 minutes of TV generally, but I will defer to others on whether it is exceptional for Taskmaster.
All right. Thank you. Danny, you have been immersed in Taskmaster with your family since we basically forced you to watch it on your last visit to Austin. Why don't you go next?
You are not wrong. It's been one of my favorite things to watch since then. And the other Taskmaster episode that's in the canon is the premiere of the second season. And since we brought it back to Newfoundland, we have been acting as some sort of Johnny Taskmaster seed, because we have played that episode to so many people, because it's a great way for them to get an idea of what the series is about. This is a great episode of television, too. I wouldn't introduce people to Taskmaster with this episode only because it's the finale. But as far as Taskmaster episodes go, when I saw this one as a possibility in the doc, I looked it up and I saw which one it was. And I said, oh, that's where they sing the songs about Rosalind. And you have the one song that's a pretty good song that they came up with in 30 minutes. And then you have the fantastic thing. And Greg Davies talked about it when he was assessing the task, is that you can't believe that when tasked to write a song about this person, that they would choose to include the lyric, "Rosalind is a fucking nightmare." But it's amazing. That's why they're comedians, and that's why I'm not, because it works. And I would never have thought of it. I really like the series cast a lot. There's something to like about all of them. One of the clips, you could hear Nish's high-pitched screech giggle that he busts out whenever something strikes him as particularly funny, and is always delightful to hear. This is a great episode. And if you haven't watched Taskmaster yet, you don't start with this one, but I think it belongs in the canon, and start at the beginning.
When this one came up and I saw the cast, the first thing I thought was, yes, this is truly an all killer, no filler cast. There are other seasons where you're like, I wish I could put the Rose Matafeo season higher in my own personal ranking, but there are two duds on that one in the cast, not just one. And then this one, I think they're all complete joys. Bob Mortimer, I didn't appreciate when we watched this season the first time how weird he is. And that's saying something considering he says some very weird things in this season. But if you watch him on the British Would I Lie to You, he's truly like so chaotic. He tells the most outlandish lies and also the most outlandish true stories. Like, you cannot pin him down. And so when we get to the task where he's asking Rosalind, he's trying to get to know her for songwriting purposes. And as Greg enumerates at the end, like, all of his questions are insane. Have you stolen much? Would you like to be able to fly?
Like, What's your favorite meat?
Yeah, it's your favorite meat.
Rosalind's a Nightmare had to have come from Bob.
Yeah.
But I mean, Sally and Aisling would have signed off on it, but I thought Bob had to come up with that line.
For sure. And Kit is right about the cast dynamic, for sure. The other thing is that most seasons, I would say, when you watch, there's like a season victim often. In this one, it was Nish, and he comes in last place, as we see. And a season favorite, who is Sally Phillips. Greg obviously like has a little, totally, I would say, probably non-sexual crush on her, but she gets a lot of like high points on stuff where I wouldn't have necessarily gone that high, but he's obviously a little bit Twitter-pated about her in it, as again, a not inappropriate way, just in a, you know, he thinks she's neat. And so it was nice to see that dynamic play out in this episode as well. Kit is definitely right about the Rosalind songs, A, being a series best task execution, and also combining two things that the show does well, which is the short-term artistic challenge and getting to know a stranger. This was also something we saw in the other episode that is in the canon with Fred the Swede, where they're trying to to learn facts about him. They can't speak English. Kit really said it all. This is adults playing a kid's game, trying to figure out the workarounds of like how to get sneaky, and it's still early enough that they don't necessarily always have a built-in trapdoor in tasks where it's like, you know, if you look under the table, you'll see the answer, or it'll say, pull this out and you win, or whatever. Like, that happens more often now. In season 5, it was not so frequent. And so that gives this episode a kind of sweet purity. And I'll also say two more things just in Taskmaster world. It was announced last week that an Australian version is coming. We have watched all 3 seasons of the Taskmaster New Zealand. The middle one is very good. 1 and 3 are fine. Season 2, I think, of New Zealand is a standout. So we'll reserve judgment of Australia. And the other is, if you enjoy Aisling in this episode, watch her show This Way Up on Hulu. I've mentioned it before, but it's a very lovely, thoughtful, sweet sitcom. A lot of good sister stuff with her and Sharon Horgan. And that's it, Dave.
All right. I don't disagree with where Kit landed, which is like, you know, it's 20 million points. I'm a little worried about her scoring inflation and how that's going to work for future episodes that she may consider. But I will say that I think that there actually are a couple weak challenges in this episode. I think the pun thing was a dud. I didn't think that worked. Like, I don't think it was
saved. She was floundering.
Yeah.
Well, yes. She didn't even use that. I saved it.
But I don't think, like, there was no real purpose to Alex Horn doing all that, because he had all the time in the world versus her concentrated one. Like, it didn't really, like, it was just like to show off, and I guess that's a little funny, but like as a challenge it didn't really work for me. Minor nitpick, because it was a very small little throwaway bit of the episode. But I thought the graph challenge was bad and boring, absolutely saved by Bob Mortimer being there. Like, yeah. If it wasn't for him and his, what the hell is he talking about? Where did this idea come from? And then there's this whole revenge thing with throwing piss on some guy's boat. It was like so fucking crazy that it actually turned that around. And I absolutely forget about everything else in that challenge. The only thing I can remember is this graph with piss and his story about collecting piss in large quantities and how would you go about collecting piss in various English counties and all this sort of stuff. It was madness of the highest caliber. And it reminded me, like, as Tara was saying, I didn't really appreciate him to the extent I do now watching it, watching the season the first time around. Since then, we've watched other panel shows such as Would I Lie to You and 9 out of 10 Cats.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That he's also really good on. But there's this all-time segment on Would I Lie to You, the story about this robot lion he had when he was a student at school. And it's just so fucking crazy. But he tells it with just like absolute, like, dead accuracy and just like all the details seem like they have been previously crafted, like, you know, by a room full of writers. There's no way. And it's like, it's just madness. He's just one of those guys that if you sat down and you had to write his biography, previous jobs would probably take you 3 weeks to get through, right? He seems like one of those guys, you know. I was a coal miner and also I was like the astronaut's assistant. Like, what? Like that kind of thing. So I think he pulled that one out of the fire. I feel like that challenge would have been a dud without him. And then, of course, he really shines when it comes to the end with the song, where I think you can definitely see the influence that he brings with Rosalind is a fucking nightmare. And the egg one, people throwing it up, like if everybody got like 5 or 6, it would have been whatever. The fact that everybody basically just biffed it right away was yes. funny. But, yes. you know, did they know that was going to happen? Did they do a whole bunch of trials and it was like 20% success rate in trials? We'll never know. It definitely worked on the screen, but I didn't see it working on paper. So I was mm-hmm. sort of surprised that the ending actually sort of worked and it wasn't as large of a come down from the song as it could have been.
Yeah. Live tasks are always, I feel like, the most wild card because that's the one where editing can't save something that was like maybe didn't totally work.
Well, and the sound effect when Nish breaks his egg is like perfect because it's not too loud, but there's definitely this sad little crunch.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, oh, well, that's that storyline coming to its natural conclusion. So, yeah.
When you think about task creation being one element, guests being another element, and the synergy between them, and just random chance, right? Like some of these things that just sort of happened. And I think it all clicked really well here. Let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you? Canon worthy or not?
Yes, all the units of piss in my heart for this one. Yeah, for sure.
Dan?
Yes, definitely.
Tara?
Yes, for me as well.
And me too. So. Taskmaster Series 5, Episode 8, Their Water's So Delicious. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
I sure do. If you are of a certain age, you saw the 1996 film Fear, in which Mark Wahlberg is a bad boyfriend, spoiler, and Reese Witherspoon and her family, which includes her dad, William Peterson, have to try to avoid getting killed by him, pretty much. And why this is in our doc is because Peacock is developing a series inspired by it. I watched the movie again last year because we talked about Mother May I Sleep with Danger, the Tori Spelling TV movie, on our sister podcast, Again with This, on the Patreon for that. The reason that I watch Fear is it's basically exactly the same plot. Both are great. And if they're making a Mother May I Sleep with Danger series, I would watch that as well. But this is joyful news for me. I'm excited to watch it.
And loser of the week?
Oh, boy. TV true crime. First of all, Hulu's Devil in the White City series. This has just been bedeviled in the whole of its development life, which goes back to like the aughts.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, Hulu was like, nope, it's going to series. We're doing it. And Keanu Reeves is going to be in it. Woo. Well, Keanu bailed last week. And now director Todd Field is out as of like this morning. I think that was announced mm-hmm. as we're recording this. So that's not great. And also this Netflix Dahmer thing, which is like technically the name is like Monster : Dahmer : Everyone Hates This Motherfucker. Another victim's family has come forward to criticize Netflix about it. But every time you're on Netflix, like it's still like two or three on the carousel. Like, I mean, people are watching it, but the families have legitimate beef, and this is not a great look for Ryan Murphy. And dishonorable mention to the crimes committed against Mexico and the taco on the most recent episode of The Great British Bake Off. I'm just going to say mustache cake and leave it at that. But we just watched it last night, and it was like, it was just as bad as we had been led to believe, and in some ways even worse.
Yeah, it's really true that, like, when you know about the controversy, because we had read about it for, you know, several days before we actually got to the episode, and then when the, you know, the screen comes up and it's Noel and Matt in their serape ponchos, it's like, oh no. it's bad from immediately. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, it is from the jump very bad. And that actually leads me to my plugs. If you would like more criticism of true crime in this vein, Eve Beatty and I write a newsletter. It comes out every weekday. It is called Best Evidence, and you can find it at bestevidence.fyi. Guys, speaking of things that are very bad from the jump, do you know what time it is?
Is it a game time by Sarah?
It's non-regulation game time by Buncey.
Look, you didn't really give me an opening. You kind of went right through it.
Yep.
I would be remiss if I didn't jump onto the chance.
Yes.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now Dahmer for having listened to it. I award you no points. And may God have mercy on your soul.
Nice segue into my game time, too. Yeah. It's me with a game time called Novel Ideas. Nothing, says cynical cash grab, quite like the novelizations of TV shows that spring up around suddenly white-hot programming. And even the most cynical among this panel might find themselves surprised at just how many television shows have put out ancillary cargo pocket-sized paperbacks over the years. Now that we can just put television itself into a cargo pocket, these TV show novelizations have become a relic of a time gone by. But that doesn't mean we can't use them in a non-regulation game time called Novel Ideas. The winner of this game, in case you were wondering what's at stake, may force in me in an upcoming Around the Dial segment with whatever program they wish. That's for the winner. And one of the novelizations in the game is available as a quote prize for one quote lucky listener. Which novelization? You won't know until I send it to you. DM me on Twitter at Tomato Nation to be considered, and I will random draw a big wiener later this week. I can't guarantee you'll get a show you want, but I can tell you I will ship it anywhere in the world.
You know who else enjoys a big wiener? Jeffrey Dolan.
Dave. Jesus.
Here's how the game works. Dave is eliminated. Just kidding. I will read you the title of a novelization with the show's name redacted and one line of the jacket copy. Guess the name of the show being novelized for 3 points. If you can't get it off the copy, I will give you the name of the actor or actors playing the characters referenced in the jacket copy. After that, it's 1 point. The character name will not be redacted unless it's also the show's title. So, if I read you the title, Redacted, M-dash, Which Way to the Beach? And here's the copy. Brandon's new job at the beach club looks like the opportunity of a lifetime. Sun, sand, and babes in bikinis. But things aren't always the way they seem. The show is probably
Beverly Hills 90210.
Correct. And if you did not get it from that, I would, of course, tell you that the actor who plays Brandon is Dame Helen Mirren. Just kidding, it's Jason Priestley. This fine novelization was written by Mel Gilden, in case anyone wants to try to find it on eBay. No shows are repeated, no penalty for guessing at any level, no steel mills or gross worth equalizing. And Tara, if you could keep score, I believe we are ready to play Novel Ideas, Picky. What are we doing?
We will start with Tara.
Okay, our order is Tara, Dove, and Danny. Here we go. Novel ideas. Question number one. Redacted, resurrecting Ravana. As tensions in the school escalate into brutal acts of violence and the perpetrators turn up horribly mutilated, Redacted and the gang search for a supernatural source.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Correct.
Hey.
That is 3 points for Tara. Dave, this question is for you.
Yes.
Redacted, Before the Dawn. Surviving among a ragtag pack of street kids, agile as a cat and an expert thief, Max steals from the rich and gives to Moody, her mentor in crime and leader of the gang.
Wow.
Girl Max, that's some data.
All right, well, there's some character names there, but I can't place that. The only Max I know is from Heart to Heart. So Heart to Heart.
It is not Heart to Heart. I regret to inform you. Moody is a new slash novel only character, but Max is played by Jessica Alba.
Okay, well, the only Jessica Alba show I know is Dark Angel.
Okay. 1 point.
Never watched one episode of that. So
no, we
I don't
watched
feel
the pilot.
Bad. No, we didn't.
Yes, we did.
That was plenty.
We did.
Okay, Daniel McCachran. Redacted number two, kill Huggy Bear. A 50 grand favor. That's what Huggy Bear agreed to when he offered to return the swag from a misbegotten heist. A heist that dipped deep into gangland pockets.
Well, if I'm right, this is a show that predates me, but I believe Huggy Bear is from Starsky and Hutch.
Correct. He was played by Antonio Fargas. That book was by Max Franklin. He wrote a bunch of these. Okay, back to Tara. Redacted goes to Las Vegas. It was to be a small, intimate wedding at Nero's Villa, with Radar as the lovesick groom and Christina Korski-Rimsikov as his blushing bride.
MASH.
That book took two people to write, Richard Hooker and William E. Butterworth, and, of course, Gary Berghoff played Radar. Christina was novelization only. Back to Dave.
Yes.
Redacted, Mary's story. Big sis Mary seems to have it all together. She's practical, super smart, beautiful, vivacious, and a rising star in her school's basketball team.
Mary, basketball, school, assuming high school. Mary.
Why you bugging?
Yeah. I'm just going to go straight for the hint, please.
Jessica Biel plays Mary.
Oh, okay. Is this Seventh Heaven?
Hey.
It is.
Did we watch the pilot of that one, Tara?
No.
No, I didn't.
Oh, God. Now that song's going to be stuck in my head, and I did it to myself. Back to Danny. Redacted, The Burning Man. As she grew, Olivia sought to escape a violent life, but no matter where she ran, her past caught up to her until she couldn't run anymore.
I can think of two shows that have Olivia in them, but I'm not sure that I like either one of these for this, but I'm going to guess the bigger one, and that's Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
Ooh.
I think you probably have it with your other choice, but in case you don't, Olivia was played by Anna Torv in the show.
God damn it, Fringe!
Correct for 1 point. And that book was written by someone whose last name was Faust?
Huh.
Is it on sale?
No.
Would you say it is
you would like the price, Dave.
I would not say it's a bargain, no.
Thank you.
Dave. And any other Dahmer bits before I move on?
Yes, but I'll spare you.
Will you? Because I don't believe you. Back to Tara.
Yep.
Redacted. No good deed. Michael has been taken, kidnapped by a frantic father in a desperate move to save his dying daughter. Chad Newcomb is sure Michael was the one who performed last Christmas's miracle, healing ill children in a hospital.
Oh my God. Is this Highway to Heaven?
That was my guess.
That's an excellent guess.
Okay.
Was that character's name Newcomb? Like
Chad Newcomb,
who was just in the novel.
Any relation to Duke Newcomb?
Newcomb.
Not Newcomb.
No.
Not like Duke Newcomb.
Duke Newcomb. Michael was played by Brendan Fair.
Oh, Roswell.
Correct, for 1 point. This book also took two people to write. I should really stop making fun of people who pair up to write books about TV. Dave, back to you.
Yeah.
Redacted, The Accident. The family learned the hard way that one neighbor was less than honest, and it took Aaron's varmint, as Grandma scathingly referred to the mischievous but well-meaning goat, to set forces in motion to straighten everything out for Redacted.
Okay, so you said Redacted means his characters in the show title, correct?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so can you read that once more? Because I had something in mind, and then it is no longer possible, and all my information dropped out.
Gotcha. Redacted, the accident. Uh-huh. The family learned the hard way that one neighbor was less than honest, and it took Aaron's varmint, as Grandma scathingly referred to the mischievous but well-meaning goat, to set forces in motion to straighten everything out for Redacted.
A goat?
Not the greatest of all time, like an actual animal.
Oh.
I think.
Oh. That feels like that should be a slam dunk clue, a goat in a TV show. But the only goat in a TV show I can think of would be like, okay, well, something on a farm. It's not Green Acres. That's not a character's name. So what farm? The man, why am I doing so bad at this game? All right, clue, please.
Mary Beth McDonough plays Aaron, and Ellen Corby played Grandma.
Oh. Oh God! All right.
Yeah. Sorry. Picky was mean to you.
Is this the dramatization of Hee Haw?
That's an excellent guess, but no, this is The Waltons.
Oh, well, that mm-hmm. kind of is. All right, fine.
Yeah, it is. Back to Danny. Redacted on patrol. Randy Disher is perfectly happy living with Redacted's old assistant, Sharona, and working as the new police chief of Summit, New Jersey.
I don't know any part of that, so I'm going to have to ask for a hint.
I'm not sure this is going to help you, but Randy Disher is played by Jason Gray Stanford, and Biddy Schramm plays Sharona.
Let's go with Heart to Heart.
Summit, New Jersey is played by a soundstage. No, that's Monk.
Never watched it.
Monk. Back to Tara. Redacted number one, Crossfire! Exclamation point. With one player wounded and maybe dying, Hondo and his strike force had only an hour to outwit the kidnappers, or they'd start sending out a dead player every 15 minutes until the ransom was paid.
I know I should know it from Hondo, but I don't. Is it Chips?
That's a good guess, though. Hondo is played by Steve Forrest.
No.
Steve Forrest.
No.
She can't see it.
Is it room 222? I have no idea.
Steve Forrest played Hondo on SWAT, famous original flavor.
A show people only know for the theme song, I think.
I'm pretty sure that's true.
And this one novel.
Of course.
Yeah.
And yet the CBS, like the current one, has probably been on for like 8 seasons at this point.
Yeah. I feel like they also only know it for Hondo. It's mm-hmm. like the man tooth of that show.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dave, I don't love your chances here, but right. Let's forge ahead.
Maybe I'll
Redacted.
Yeah.
Redacted, the underground picnic. Uh-huh. Convinced that spying was for the birds, Redacted tried to set things right and introduced the military to the world's greatest secret weapon, utter confusion.
Is this Get Smart?
That's a good guess.
I
but
like
alas,
that guess.
No. Redacted is played by Sally Fields.
Oh, Redacted. Wouldn't have been Get Smart. Shit. Sally Fields.
Could have been. That's his name. Maxwell Smart.
Oh, okay. Sure. Thank you for that save. Sally Field?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell was that show? Is this, No.
For the birds is a key part of this.
Yeah, that's good.
I know. Birds? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know what it is. I can't remember what it's called. It's definitely not what I think was about to say, because my brain works in mysterious and terrible ways now. Flipper.
oh, God.
Wait, is it just called the... Oh, wait.
You're about to say it, I think.
It sounds like you're about to say it, Dave.
You're so close.
There's two things. I can't remember which one it is. If
what do birds do?
I know. Okay. Okay. All right. All right.
Do they pray?
Let me just talk you through where I was going.
They suddenly appear.
I have an answer, and I'll give you the answer at the end of my Let's Discover How Dave's Brain Doesn't Work.
We're
First, I thought
dumber.
Flipper. My brain was going is it was trying to remember Gidget,
right?
Which is not the show that we're talking about, because we're talking about the one where she's the flying nun.
Yes.
Yay!
1 point. hard one indeed. Okay, back to Danny, and then we will take a quick score break. Redacted, Dangerous Desire. But Bobby might still be alive somewhere. He might need help. She had to do something.
Wait, that's it?
That's it?
That's it.
Well,
I have a guess.
I have a guess, and it's based on Bobby and the double D's, and I'm going to say Dallas.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yay! Points.
Patrick Duffy and Victoria Principal is the she. In question, let's take a quick break and get those scores, please, T-Bone.
Well, that just changed everything. Dave has 3 points.
Yay!
Danny and I are tied with 7 points each.
Excellent.
Okay, everyone has 2 questions left.
No.
Let's do this.
Okay.
Back to Tara. Redacted, a video novel.
Mm.
Ever since that space-happy wanderer Redacted fell to Earth, life has taken some zany turns for Redacted and her family, not to mention the rest of Boulder, Colorado.
Oh. Is that Mork and Mindy?
Sure is. 3 points.
I was like, Starman? And then they're like, this is the girl named Starman, too?
My first thought was, I Dream of Jeannie. He didn't fall. He just came back.
This book is, quote, a story told in photographs taken right from their smash hit show. It is, quote, written by Richard J. Inobili, and it costs like $45 on eBay, so y'all not getting that one.
So.
It feels like sure that was available via Scholastic back in the
day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But this is like the one that doesn't have mustard stains on it, so it's $45.
Shot spot.
Dave, back to you. Feeling good about this one for you. Redacted, the Sweat Hog News Hogs.
Ah, okay, got it.
It all started innocently enough. Freddie Boom Boom Washington wrote a story for the school newspaper, telling of the school's brilliant basketball star, a super cool, super bad dude who does it all, Freddie Boom Boom Washington.
Well, if it's Sweat Hogs, it's got to be set on a farm, so my answer is obviously going to be Green Acres again. that is Welcome Back, Cotter.
Yes, it is. 3 points for Dave.
Yay.
All right. Back to Danny. Redacted, Day of Descent. When the great ship lands on Earth, the future of the Tanktonese and all humanity depends on two unlikely heroes, Matt and George, who must work together for the first time to prevent a disaster that could destroy both their peoples.
All right, I'm not so good with the sci-fi shows, but it's about a ship landing on Earth, you say?
When the great ship lands on Earth.
The great ship. Let's say V.
Good guess. Not sure if the casting is going to help you, but Matt is played by Gary Graham and George is Eric Pierpoint.
Oh, this is a trick question. You made those people up. Those people don't actually exist.
I have a guess.
Only in space.
okay, well, let me guess another sci-fi show. Let's say Alien Nation.
Correct.
Yeah, that's my guess. Yeah. Nice.
All right, everybody's last question coming at you. It sounds like this is still in contention. Here we go. Tara, are you ready?
Yes.
Redacted, recruited. All Sydney ever wanted was acceptance. Friends who cared about her. Parents who loved her. A place where she could fit in.
Oh, Alias.
Correct for 3 points. Although, if you had guessed Melrose, that would have been 3 points, because
she also got
true.
Recruited to things.
Yeah, and it is all she ever wanted was acceptance. All right, Dave, this is your last question.
Don't you want to ask me if I'm ready? Because, you know, to build the tension in case I come through and go into first?
No,
it's not happening now.
Redacted, declassified, colon, death angel.
Green Acres.
Caught in the crossfire between two rival criminal operations, each intent on controlling the terrifying machinery of apocalypse, the rogue anti-terrorism operative has redacted hours to forestall America's worst nightmare.
Wait. Okay, I mean, I have a pretty good guess, but can you just read that again? Because it sounds like they might have been doing some Bring It On horror mix-ups there. One more time, just for, you know, for fun.
Caught in the crossfire between two rival criminal operations, each intent on controlling the terrifying machinery of capital A apocalypse, the rogue anti-terrorism operative has redacted hours to forestall America's worst nightmare.
Well, I mean,
Don't talk yourself out of it.
No. I mean, hours, blanks, blah. I mean, it sounds like a really fucked up version of 24.
Take it, run. Okay, that's three points.
Wait. Can we just break this down? First, okay, so is Apocalypse the name of an organization in that, or is that just the?
No, I think it's just the Apocalypse, and they're being dramatic.
It's not Apocalypse, but it's an initialism, and they've dropped a couple letters from it.
There are seriously like 15 of these books, and I had to read the copy of all of them to get one that didn't call him like everything capitalized and then Jack Bauer.
This
was like the best I could do.
And they're saying criminal organizations, and it sounds like it's just like the local like Italian Businessmen's League is one of them, like really trying to get this like Apocalypse bomb or something.
I mean, I think it basically is versus the Knights of Columbus, and they're all like in Mount Weather scuffling over a dirty bomb.
No.
Like,
there's a Sopranos no neck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I'd vote for that for the no neck. All right, let's wrap this up. Danny, you ready?
I am ready.
Redacted, binding ties. Shut up, Dave. 10 years ago, Las Vegas was terrorized by Cast, a vicious serial killer responsible for nearly half a dozen brutal murders and who tested the mettle of the LVPD's new captain, Jim Brass.
Well, if it's Las Vegas, let me just say CSI.
CSI Original Flavor is correct. That one was written by Max Allen Collins, who wrote a bunch of these. Same names over and over. Okay, what names are at the top of our scoreboard?
This was a very, very close, hard-fought game. Dave finished with 9, Danny 11. I barely ahead with 13.
Very well done.
Very nice.
Good job.
Good job.
For poops and smiles.
Yay.
Here's a tiebreaker. The winner gets one steel meal, but they will have to give it to another player.
Ah.
Is everyone ready to play?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Redacted, the wall. As Missy, he feels small and helpless. What can a child do to alter the fate? Yes, correct.
Who gets that steel meal, Dave?
I'm going to give it to Sarah D. Bunting.
Thanks, buddy.
Fantastic and fun novelization game.
Yeah.
Thank you. And plenty of material left, I regret to inform everyone.
Tara.
Good job, Tara. Dave, sorry about the flying nun.
That was fun. Thank you, Sarah. Guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Alaska Daily was our headlining topic before we crashed the car, listening to Sarah give her I am not a crackpot argument in the front seat. We went around the dial with stops at The Real Love Boat, Reboot, The Winchesters, and Werewolf by Night. Kit's task was to get Taskmasters Their Waters So Delicious into the canon, and she scored 4 out of a possible 4 points. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Sarah. Next up, bringing on genre moves, and on the next EHG Prime, it's The Watcher. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Redacted Hours,
Sarah D. Bunting,
It's in a Walk,
and Danny McEachern,
Household Amounts of Piss.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
So yeah, I'm done. I'm done. I'm done. Now, if you could leave so that I could get back to work.
Ants.